Hi, and welcome to Song Divers, an interview podcast about singer-songwriters.
We like to go deep in conversation with our favorite musicians in search of honest answers.
What are the ingredients of a great song?
What makes a songwriter tick?
Can a musician make a living these days?
Is Jason Isbell overrated?
What?
My name is Stefan.
And this is Ed.
And our guest this episode has the nerve and the talent to write a song on stage in front of a live audience.
Hi, this is Kirk Adams.
Itching for answers, scratching for change. The things I believe in are causing me pain. Hold you forever, I won't ever leave. Sacrifice anything to get you to see. I'm queuing up for the Hindenburg. I'm queuing up for the Hindenburg.
I like my songwriting with a healthy dash of doom and gloom, which always goes down nicely with chiming guitars and a catchy tune. Kirk Adams gives us all of that in spades. A longtime staple of the Tampa Bay music scene, Kirk is both a critic's darling and an audience favorite. His songs can be fun, thought-provoking, touching, creepy, sometimes all of those in the same song. Like some sci-fi PI, Kirk trawls the sights and sounds of his fellow creatures of the night and shows us ourselves in an honest, compelling light. Wielding his trusty Strat in his signature shades and pork pie hat, he's chasing nothing more than DIY therapy and to make a living doing what he was born to do. And as a result, his freaks have found him. Ladies and gentlemen, Kirk Adams.
Kirk, we usually start everybody with telling us where you're from.
I was born in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, many moons ago, Holy Cross Hospital on Federal Highway.
Did you grow up in Fort Lauderdale also?
I grew up in Pompano Beach, Fort Lauderdale area, adjacent Deerfield Beach, and yeah, South Florida.
And how long did you live there?
Oh, I lived there till I was about 18, 19, and moved up to Ocala for a little while.
Okay. And did you live with your mom, dad, family, big family, small family?
Yeah. Well, I had four siblings and mom and dad, yeah.
And music in the household?
Yes. They were all musicians. My second oldest brother was a guitar player, and my brother below him was a bass player. My sister played keyboards at the time, piano as well.
You had a whole band.
Yeah, you needed a drummer.
They all played together in a band. And then my very oldest brother, I should not mention, he was also a musician. He enjoyed more like the barbershop quartet than operatic spectrum.
So. I'm going to assume their band was not called the Addams Family?
No. That's probably a reason we didn't play in a band together very often, to avoid that.
to avoid having to use that
name? Of course, I love the Addams Family, so what's the big deal, right? You know,
yeah.
What's not to like?
How about your parents? Were they musical?
Not really, not at all. They came from North Carolina. They came from up in the mountains. Mm-hmm. Originally, and then Winston-Salem. And so my mom knew some sort of folky tune stuff. Doug would play guitar, and she'd sing, Little Rosewood Casket, and she'll be coming around the mountain when she comes. And
Little Rosewood Casket.
Like that. But, not really.
That kind of lays the groundwork for the whole feel of all your songs.
That and you said they did some time through Salem, too. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
I'm feeling a theme. Yeah.
See it all? There's a big thread. We're going to find that thread today.
That's interesting. The parents that weren't necessarily musical or playing instruments, and yet your whole siblingage, you guys were all musical.
Yeah, I blame Doug specifically because he's the one who sort of, decided to play the electric guitar.
He's your oldest brother?
He's the second oldest, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. And, had the long hair. And
you think it's just the climate of the day, like the Beatles, Elvis, whatever, had him hooked,
I think so.
Yeah.
Not just Beatles, but,
the same reason everybody we know is a guitar player.
Yeah, I think so. my brother was a big fan of Rory Gallagher, the Irish guitar player, and a lot of other people, too. I always point to him because I feel like he gets underrepresented, you know, Ry Cooder and you know, all kinds of those kind of players, and not to mention just the regular rock and roll dudes, you know. So yeah, all that stuff was in the house, and all that stuff I listened to subliminally to some degree. I was thinking about it today because all songwriting conversations come around to the Beatles at some point, and I can remember listening to the Beatles a lot when I was little, but I didn't really. It wasn't like you were listening to them. I mean, they were sort of happening to you, you know. And then I remember, like, when I was older, and I started like really kind of starting to dig back into the tunes, it'd be like, oh wow, this is really cool. This is really strangely interesting. Before, it was just in the air, like oxygen, you know.
Well, it's an interesting point that you make, because I was thinking about that too, reading kind of some of the forward before the show, and some of the stuff that you mentioned about influences. And I think guys for different generations, your guys' generations, like, that's probably true. For me, it was hearing other people playing that had been influenced by the Beatles. You know what I mean? So, like, I knew about them, I was listening to them, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't this huge cataclysmic shock like some of those bands were when they were really first hitting, you know? And you've talked to me about that before. We talked about it on the show, like, what a thing that was, you know? And my generation generally doesn't get to experience, didn't get to experience that sort of thing. So we're being influenced by it through you guys, you know?
Well, yeah, and just not just us, but just the you know, visceral impact that the Beatles had on every artist, you know, still to this day. There's something you can usually, you find some sort of connection to. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they did a lot of work, a lot of the work themselves. They did.
So were you like hankering to play an instrument at the time, or were you just being like, oh, all my siblings are doing it, I like music, or were you being like really influenced by something that?
No, not really. I. they had music in the house. They played and rehearsed with their bands in the house and stuff. So, I mean, there was always an instrument around. There was always maybe a little opportunity to play a little bit and stuff. But I wasn't really initially heading that direction, you know. Mm-hmm. I was pretty young, you know. It wasn't until later that it just sort of started to happen. And, you know, it became a viable way to make money, which was, you know, a surprise. But really, I mean, I've always, you know, written songs and I started to get sort of a little bit more of my, I feel like, a little bit more attention from my siblings when I began to write songs. They're like, oh, Kirk writes songs.
Well, I mean, that's a
Who's
thing.
Who's all that coming, you know? And so that became sort of a little bit of an identifying factor. At least that's the way it felt to me. They can tell me later if that's not the case.
Well, and to say, oh, I've always written songs, I mean, that's not a throwaway comment. I mean, so do you remember when you first sort of had that wellspring of wanting to write? And do you remember what you were writing about?
Oh, yeah. I remember all those. Yeah, I remember all those songs. Just the, you know, bad ones and the, you know. I remember one day in particular. I think it was Thanksgiving, and everybody was around the video games, and they were messing around with video games. And I was the little brother, and I wasn't getting the chance to play. You know, so I remember going off into the bedroom and writing a song. You know, and then like later, I'm like, yeah, I think I wrote a song.
It's called Greedy Siblings.
It was a love song to Jane Wedlin from the Go-Go's.
Oh wow!
Yeah. Would you like to hear a little bit of it?
Yeah, we would.
Rattle out that
pubescent pop tune.
I'll try to just stay seated like this.
Let's hear it.
Oh, yeah.
Do you mention Jane Wedlin in the song, or is it veiled?
Jane. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's remember.
This is a treat.
That's pretty funny. You'll laugh. Because it's, you know, kid song, you know. Yeah, it was kind of fun chord progression, though. Probably a Cars song, maybe, you know.
I love the Cars.
I don't know you, but I'd like to know just what it is that makes you go, go, go. I saw you dancing in the video. Your face so alive and your eyes aglow. Jane, please let me explain. I'll never be the same since I saw you. Since I saw you. Jane, please let me explain. I'll never be the same since I saw you. Since I saw you. You know, short arms.
Yeah. Pretty good, actually.
That's awesome.
Got the little Beatle ripoff.
Kirk, usually we'll ask people about like the first song they wrote, you know? Like,
well, that's not the first song, but that's like a very early song.
Even an early one that they remember, you know, we're like, oh, you want to play that? And like, hell no.
Are you
kidding?
I don't want to
play. Yeah, like, absolutely not. That was great, man.
I forgot how high I could sing when I was,
maybe
know,
Jane will hear that 12. And kind of like respond like somehow.
Yeah, I don't think she would be interested, though.
I just read something about her.
We'll ask
recently.
Her when she comes on next week.
Yeah. Yeah, please do. Make sure I'm here.
You know, Buddy Kirk was here. Yeah,
I recently read something about her. Is she
here's Skylar, and here's Kirk, just standing around.
Is she a D'Angelico Guitars
artist?
I think so.
Really?
She's on my list.
That's a weird thing to know.
I'm going
to
check.
She's on my list.
That's a weird thing to know.
Well, we'll tell you about it later.
Yeah, yeah, please do. So. Make sure you play her that. Me howling like a badger.
So, Kirk, you're like early teen years writing that, it sounds like.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I wish I could write like that now, and I'm in my early 30s, so.
That's awful nice. It started me on the path of being what was different about me, you know, like what I was going to be, you know. And, of course, I went through a lot of life just, you know, playing music for a living, but always writing and always trying to get better at that and focusing on songwriting and, you know, like I've mentioned before, it's, you know, a lot of therapy for me to write about stuff and get it out of your system. I know I read that all the time. I mean, that's not like a new thing, you know, for songwriters, but.
No, but everybody does it differently.
Yeah.
You know,
and I don't really write to write a hit, which, of course, has always been probably a, you know, reason among the thousand reasons why I'm not wealthy man.
Well,
were you a writer in general? Like, did you have a journal and kind of jot things down?
I was
going
to say, you're being cavalier about that, but I think that that's actually a big topic, you know?
Like, yeah.
Writing to write a hit versus writing because it's something meaningful and authentic and real. And, like, why? What makes a hit a hit, right? Is it because the human brain hears the specific chords, or is it because they relate and they get what you're doing? You
right.
know?
Well, I think that there's an industry that is in charge of trying to figure out how to write hits called the music industry. Mm-hmm.
There are algorithms
yeah.
for that.
Yeah, so. They actually are, you know, trying to figure that out.
It's called the marijuana industry.
And, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's no answer for that. I mean, everybody deserves a living. You know, how you write songs, things you want to write. Just to me, it's never been anything that's interesting to me. If you wrote something and it happened to be catchy and good, it'd be like, well, there you go, you got something. But, I mean, anytime I've sat around and tried to write something, you know, catchy or good or a hit or something, is like, it's just terrible, you know? It's just a terrible thing.
Well, I don't know if that's a fair representation, too. We should probably say, too, that, you know, we've seen you play a bunch, and we're really familiar with your work, and I wouldn't classify any of your stuff as not catchy. You know,
maybe
some of what you feel like is, like, unconventional lyrics or unconventional takes on things, which
right.
I could certainly get. But there's a lot of really catchy stuff that I'll be humming for days after.
Oh, that's
you
cool.
know?
Yeah.
But I think that's important for people to note too, because you're being very casual about, like, oh, I've always written songs, and like, but that's to write that early on. And then you mentioned too that it was a viable way to make a living. I'm curious too, were you making a living playing original stuff out, or were you covering stuff?
Oh,
when
no.
you first started?
You know, no, by and large, you know, the money coming in was from, you know, cover up bands and rock bands and, you know, all the different styles of music that, you know, went through the years. But always writing, you know, in the background, always recording and trying to do stuff. But really, I mean, it's been in the more recent years that there's more opportunities for independent artists to get music out there. And you really don't have to write for the big leagues, I think, as much as you just need to be authentic about what you write. And you're going to find the people who like your music. I have a friend, Tom McWilliams, who did pretty good in the music industry. He, you know, worked out of the Miami Sound Machine and all the things that connected with that. And he has a blog where he talks about music. And he talks about finding your freaks, which I thought was just a beautiful way of putting it. He mm-hmm. goes, you know, you just need to, like, be authentic to yourself, do what you do, and find the freaks, the people who are freaky about what you do. And that's the best way to be successful. And he's done well, you know, so I believe him.
Well, and, the internet allows you to do that.
Absolutely, so. Which it was not that way in the, you know, even 20 years ago, really.
No, right. but it's funny how the pendulum swings, right? Because now you have access to all these people so they can hear you without you touring to them. But now there's so much stuff, it's like you can't hear anything, you know? And you can, but there's just so much noise to cut through.
Well, it seemed like there always was. But I mean, I'm sure there's more noise now. But there always was, like, you're waiting for the song to end for the next song to come on the radio, you know, the one you wanted to hear, you know. Hopefully they'll play Bohemian Rhapsody after the next song, you know.
Right.
Well, you'd be waiting a while for the next one if you don't like Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was worth the wait, I can tell you that. I can remember hearing that and being pretty blown away.
Big Queen fan?
I think that I find these things out once again as I get older. I was a real fan of A Night at the Opera album. Like, I didn't buy every Queen album. I didn't really buy anything at that time. Anyway, I was, you know, I was listening to the hand-me-downs, as it were.
Yeah.
But that album, I forgot how well I remember it. I mean, I would know every song on it. I know the track order. I mean, I must have liked it, you know. But I would never like it. You know, I was in high school, said, oh, I'm a Queen fan. Like, it probably wouldn't come up in conversation, but I clearly love that album. I loved ELO's El Dorado.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was a great record. I remember listening to it all the time. And once again, probably in my years, I wouldn't have said, oh, yeah, I'm a big ELO fan, you know. But when I think back about, like, records or things that calm me or make me happy or things that I remember really enjoying, it's a weird little cross-section. I loved Electric Warrior, T-Rex.
Oh, my gosh.
It's crazy about it, you know. I learned a lot about that in therapy, because when I would go into my therapist, she'd be like, you know, what, you know, makes you relax? What do you enjoy? You know, like, if you're going to go on a plane trip, what would you – and I'm thinking, like, well – I think T-Rex and Electric Warrior. I like that. I think, you know, you're like, you're trying to figure out, like, what would actually, you know, get you to a place, you know, and those early records do that for me. And I know they do for everybody. It's a phenomenon when you play music for a living that everybody wants to hear the music that they listened to growing up, you know, even if they're, you know, 40, 50 years old.
And do you think that's because it's just, it's because the music is that good, it's the staying power of a song?
Or I
it's
honestly nostalgia? Don't. No, I think it's nostalgia. I think it's a connection. And primarily because I think people, I don't really mean to pick on music now, but people are going to do it for music now too. You know, it's not that there's anything wrong with music now. I'm not like one of those guys who, you know, who's going to do on modern trends or modern music. And there is such an opportunity for different styles of music and different places to find music. Everything from, you know, Jason Isbell to contractually obligated to mention Jason Isbell, by the way, at some point in the conversation. Sorry, or, you know, or somebody on the R. Kelly spectrum or whatever. I mean, like, there was a wide variety of music for everybody, and there's a lot of good music going on. But there's a lot of cool independent music, and I do, and not even selfishly, but I do wish people would delve more into the local scenes of music and be more supportive of local original artists, because that's how you make a scene. That's how you make a cool community and a you know, if you ever want to have another grunge scene again or some kind of a thing, it's got to come from you going out and supporting local art.
You know, that's a really interesting thing. We haven't got to talk about this much. Ed and I have talked about this some, but I'll talk about this with some of my friends once in a while. But as I've understood it, you used to go to a venue because you knew the venue would have good music, you know? And the venue would pay well for that band to be there because you were a good band and you're performing and, like, that's what people are used to. Now, and I remember being in college and some of the shows of my buddies in bands that were just starting out, like, you're basically paying the venue to play. And there's nobody there unless you bring them. You know, you become the micro-market as the band. And, like, that's changed. So I think there's a little bit of a responsibility of a community to work together to help do that, right? Like, yes, you should seek it out. But I also think that where do you go to find it? You know, like, you have to know the venues. And you have to start to trust your local venues that I know that this place brings great bands. Or I know this band really well, and I can trust they're going to have a good band with them, you know? Which is part of why we're doing this. You know, we want people to know about great acts in this area.
Nice segue.
But it's true, but that's something that we look at. You know, we mentioned the Hideaway a lot in here, which we'll definitely talk about with you especially. But that's one of the reasons the Hideaway is so well thought of. Even by the national acts that come through and do this show with us, they mention the Hideaway, even if they haven't played it, because they know about it.
That's super nice.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think there's other ones too. Paper Crane's a newer one that, you know, is starting to get a reputation that people are starting to know. You know, Crowbar in Ybor City. Mm-hmm. And that's true of venues all across the country. You know, but I think to your point about local music, and I'd love to hear you talk about this, I think there's a venue responsibility there too for people seeking out places to see music as well as those local acts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure like everything, it takes a village, right? You know, everybody's got to be pulling their way, and, you know, the people got to go see music, and musicians got to be making music, and venues got to be having music there, you know? And another thing I like is I know a lot of the local bands have artists do their flyers, like local artists and artwork and stuff like that. And all that ties in, you know, to their merchandise, and it helps to make a scene.
For sure.
Which I think everybody wants to be in a scene, right?
Yeah. So growing up, were you thinking about that? Were you like, you're, you know, yes, music's a viable way to make money. Oh. You're starting to write songs. But were you thinking like, I'm going to be a songwriter. Like, I know this. Were you thinking of
I hit a point where I knew I would always write songs. I had a very small window of time where I was, you know, trying to, like, actually make it into the music business. I did everything pretty much wrong, you know.
like, as a songwriter?
Yeah.
Songwriter.
Yeah, in my opinion, especially in retrospect, you know, and I was just younger and I was, you know, kind of a, you know, dick, you know, I wasn't really listening to anybody, you know, I was writing songs.
Advice-wise, like, you mean?
Yeah, not really. I mean, in retrospect, more. Like, at the time, I wasn't sitting around being a dick or thinking, I'm such an awesome dick, you know? But it's more like when you look back, you kind of go, like, why did I not listen to anything anybody told me about what how to do what I'm doing, you know? But I think I felt, you know, vindicated as the downside of being an artist. I kind of felt vindicated, like, hey, man, this is my thing. This is how I write, and you're not changing a word. And no, you know, you can't add a verse. And no, you can't take a verse away, or you know, like there was just no. I wasn't helpful to the circumstance, and so you know, eventually you realize. Also, I'll tell you the other thing that really struck me is the people that I were around that did well. I realized were doing well because they were working really hard. You know,
that's a great point.
Yeah, they weren't like you know, not that they weren't talented, but like it, like a big part of what was going on was that they got up every day. And said, I'm going to work this much closer. I'm going to get this much closer to what I'm trying to do, whatever it is. You know, it's like a self-help thing. It's like, I want to do this. I'm heading that direction, and that's what I'm going to do. And really, I think in all aspects of life, that's what's going to make you successful. And it just wasn't my way.
Well, we talk about the 10,000 hours on here, right? You know, putting in 10,000 hours makes you an expert, makes you, you know, get to the place where...
I didn't know that.
Maybe you find your freaks, but...
Maybe you find your freaks, right.
But... You've got to have that song that's got staying power once you find them, right? And you've got to work really hard to find those freaks sometimes.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it seems to be, yeah. The work is definitely, if you want to be successful, I'm not a person to speak about success, but if you want to be successful from what I've seen in life, definitely the working is the mass of the job.
Well, how are you measuring success in this situation? Because I'd say, you get to write songs, you get to play, you're playing what, daily?
Well, I play as much as I want, pretty much.
Yeah,
in the nicest possible way.
You're in the trenches, though. Like, you're working every week. You're out there playing.
Yeah,
music.
I'm doing three, 4 gigs a week for sure. You know, and I'm just really lucky that I get to do as much original music as I get to do. I mean, if I was a 15-year-old kid and I went back in time and said, "Well, you're not going to be packing, you know, Shea Stadium or whatever it would be then," you know. But you know, you're going to be playing, a couple of original gigs every month and, getting to do your own music and a nice venue where you know, people come to see you and your friends come and, you know, you have a night. I'd be like, sounds like a pretty good deal. I wouldn't be upset about that. I don't think.
Totally. So we mentioned at the top of the episode, Andrew Duhon was a huge, inspiration on me, and he's one of my favorites, and he's been on the show, and we asked him, you know, what's your dream? You know, what gets you excited? And he said, you know, honestly, playing for a couple weeks, you play 400-person venues, those sell out. He's like, that to me is the dream. You know, it's not the mega tours, it's not the stadiums, it's a room of people that are there to hear your music. It's intimate, you know, and it's because you talk about like therapeutic aspect of songwriting. There's a lot of vulnerability in there.
Absolutely. You know? And knowing what you want, you know, getting what you want is success, right?
Sure.
You want to boil it down to it. That's pretty much what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so as long as you know what you want and if you're getting what you want, then I guess you're successful.
Well, you've mentioned therapy more than once and how writing is therapy to you.
Yeah.
Like what place does that come from? Like you have some demons you're trying to get out or just kind of
being human?
What drives you towards self-expression in the first place? Like,
well, I think that what drives me towards self-expression is, as we talked about, starting young, you know, playing music and writing songs, it became a way to resolve fantasy circumstances sometimes to some degree, or to have conversations with people that you know wouldn't be able to have, and maybe unearth feelings and. Or write about circumstances that you would like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Am I making any sense?
Yes.
Yeah, you're exploring things that don't necessarily present themselves in an everyday circumstance. You're kind of like exploring those nether regions.
Exploring the nether regions, yeah.
Well, in some cases...
Undertown, if you will.
So when we get to your songs, and for anybody that hasn't heard your stuff, they'll hear it on this episode, certainly... there's almost a narrator aspect to the way that you're almost commentating in some cases in your lyrics, at least the way I'm perceiving some of them, where you're the commentator on things that are going on versus talking in first person or speaking in first person, you know? And so I think to your point, and Ed, like you're saying, this idea of exploring, like, you're taking a step back and you're commentating on this conversation that you would otherwise in first person have to maybe have in life.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And I think also that's just a way of disguising yourself as the artist anyway, you know, or people write books the same way, you know, and so you take yourself out of it. But then, of course, that's not always as effective if you want to write something that's emotionally connecting. You got to put yourself into the story, at least as a proxy for your listeners, you know. So there's, I don't think you can really write any one way, you know, and be happy with your product, I don't think, you know. So you have to be able to sing honestly, as well as, I think most of the songs that I just recorded were more metaphorical in their content, you know, and allegorical and vignettes within the song. But you have to be able to write something that's direct to and emotional, or, you know, you miss out on a whole other part of therapy and songwriting, you know, in general.
When, how much of that therapy is through songwriting is getting it out and making sense of it or exploring it, like Ed was saying, versus there's the whole other aspect. Great, you've written a song, but now you have the audacity to perform it for people, right?
Right.
And how much of it is, Ronnie Elliott talked about connecting with people. Like, it was a way for him to connect, you know? Mm-hmm. And so is there a piece of that too, or is the performance just fun? You enjoy it?
No, I think that that is an aspect of being a musician and artist that I haven't really been able to understand as well as I'd like to, because I do love to perform for people, but it's not my favorite thing. And there's nothing like it. Well, obviously, as you're both musicians, nothing like it when you play one of your songs and people are not so much as applaud, obviously, but the fact that they remember it or they like it or they know it and they get it. That is, like, you know, a really, really great feeling. But I'm uncomfortable with that feeling. Like, it makes me uncomfortable to put myself in a position like that, but it is nice. So I can't speak to that only because I'm still kind of, I may always be learning how to be comfortable with performing my songs with people.
That's interesting. It's like a very deep compliment, right? So people that are maybe uncomfortable receiving compliments, and you're like, oh, you look really nice today. And you're like, oh, why not? You know. But, and then you have something that's even more deep and connecting, like a song, for someone to come up and say, wow, what you wrote was amazing. That was really something. And you're like, oh, man.
Well, yeah, because in my opinion, if you're writing properly, then you are, even obliquely, you are showing yourself to people, you know, and you're definitely showing them, depending on what you write or how you write, you know, parts of yourself or aspects of your beliefs or things that it is nice when people, you know, can connect with that, because you feel a little less, you know, like a goon or a crazy person.
Or ostracized, you know. Alienated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a nice feeling. But I mean, I never really intended to do original music or do my own songs for that purpose. More, it was always about recording and just the actual writing the song, the actual recording the music, but definitely playing things and, you know, for people has been really great.
When you do, so you have 3 or 4 albums now of material, and do you think each one is a kind of a reflection of that, the time that you're writing, or you think in terms of a collection of songs?
I think usually it's one of those things where it is in retrospect. I'm always thinking about grouping the right set of songs, and I'm always omitting something that I think doesn't fit with what's happening, you know, with the album. I don't always have a theme in mind, but usually something presents itself.
Are you thinking for the listener or for the way you want to present the songs and remember them having come out for?
I really am just trying to, in the case of making an actual album, I'm just trying to make a piece of a connected piece of work that makes sense and some kind of internal logic to it. And I think sometimes that just happens because the songs that you omit and the songs that you include, you start getting a theme, just sort of happens naturally, you know, what goes together.
I think it's interesting that we were talking about your earliest album that I'm aware of is Little Elevator. Which I think is from 2005 or something. Is that about right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned that it's kind of a downbeat album, but I'm kind of drawn to stuff like that. And some of your favorite songs for me are on that album.
Yeah, I really like it too. And it was funny because it was, once again, sort of like in retrospect, I realized, wow, these are, I think other people's reviews, I remember reading somebody's review and they were like, you know, Kirk Adams, Dark Night of the Soul, you know, I'm like, really? And then you're like, well, I kind of get it, you know?
I'm kind of drawn to that stuff anyway, like Pink Moon by Nick Drake.
Oh, yeah, you can't beat it. Beautiful. Albums, yeah.
You know, and it's like, he was clinically depressed and kind of, you know, like barely got that album into the microphone.
Yeah, I think there's something about, obviously, back to the therapy aspect of it, there's something that you're, I think if you're that kind of a artist, that you're just drawn to do it, mm-hmm. you know? And with that record, too, something that I found to be interesting about it, to me, was one of the only conscious things that I tried to do with it was I tried to eliminate as many influences, obvious influences as I could. And it comes out kind of a sparse, strange-sounding record where I just took whole parts of the arrangements out.
Are you saying that you recorded them and then later decided to leave them out?
And you mean in terms of production when you say removing influential type things that people might note?
Production,
or you mean even in the writing?
Well, I not only production but also songwriting tropes. There, mm-hmm. I use the term, you know. Mm-hmm. But some of the songs are like just a couple of verses and that's just it. I was like, there's nothing. That's all that needs to be said in this case. I don't need to go to the relative minor for a middle eight. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? It's like, it's here. This is what I have to say, and this is all I need to do with it, you know? And if I threw in some Beatlesque harmony, I'd be like, I'm not going to do that. It's going to have to go because you're going to hear that, and you're going to think Beatles. You know, like, I was trying to kind of do the opposite of what I expected, people expected from me. You know, I was kind of... I called it a deconstruction. I don't know if that's the correct artistic term, but I was kind of deconstructing the songs and the production and trying to make it something that... was, you know, ultimately interesting for me to listen to and something that I thought was different.
Mm-hmm. Would you play a song off of that album for us?
Like, sure.
What are you going to play for us?
Well, I think I'd like to play the song Lost Soul.
Sit a while at the laundromat, wait a while at the corner store. Cars in a line as far as you can see, and I hope that I can find what I was looking for. Sure, I guess I'd like to stay. You see that everyone has got to choose. If you want to walk this dying earth, you gotta put on another pair of shoes. Lost soul, you're not alone. Lost soul, come home. This could be a bad part of town. They say it's different everywhere you go. In the jungle they scowl at the city with its little houses packed all tight in a row. There's a dog sleeping in the street. You better wake before the rush hour comes. Maybe I'd be smarter not to shut my eyes and open them again all tender and young. Lost soul, you're not alone. Lost soul, come killing time. I'm pretty sure that it's all been done. The whole world's covered in yellow crime tape, and there's never any shortage of a smoking gun. Sure, I guess I'd like to stay. They say that everyone has got to choose. If you want to walk this dying earth, you better put on another pair of shoes. Lost soul, you're not alone. Lost soul, come home. Lost soul, you're not alone. Lost soul, come home.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites off that album and by you in general.
Like, I appreciate that. That song is funny because the first attention it ever got was like on a couple of Christian radio station, internet stations, of course, obviously, you know, playing it. It's funny because it's about reincarnation.
Yeah. So I didn't bother
to correct anybody. Yeah. It's a big deal, you know, and you get comfort or you enjoy what you enjoy. But it was basically about the concept of a spirit kind of deciding whether or not it wants to reincarnate into the world or just pass on into whatever's next. If you want to walk this dying earth, you got to put on a new pair of shoes was sort of the implication of, you know, of you got to come back and be reincarnated back in the world, in the jungle or in the city, you know, the differences. And the dog in the street is sort of just exemplary of bad luck and the bad things that happen, you know. With that album too, I started a lot with lyrics and I tried to work through some ideas and some things that I was thinking about philosophically. And and some of the stuff, like the actual song Little Elevator, is about, you know, being depressed and needing a little lift. I need a lift out of this, you know. And at the time, a lot of bad things were going on in the world. I think this was post 9/11 and all that stuff. And so I definitely had a very creepy look at the world. It felt like there was sort of a weird divergent universe, you know, happened there, you know. And a funny thing, too, the album ends with Soldier On, which is, I guess, the most positive thing I could come up with. Of the record, just soldier on one more day, you know.
Well, that's interesting because I think it's an example of reflecting what a lot of people were feeling. Like, maybe that is kind of the most positive thing you can, coming out of an experience like that. What else are you going to say, Kirk?
That's it. I mean, that's pretty much, that's, I think I went from the first song to the last song there. So,
going back to Lost Soul, one of my favorite, it's interesting to hear you say now that that's about reincarnation, because one of my favorite couplets from that is the dog in the street, and maybe the best thing, I'm going to paraphrase because I don't know the exact words, but maybe I should close my eyes and open them again, being tender and
young.
Like, I love that line. When I heard it, I wasn't thinking of reincarnation, but I was thinking of kind of returning to a state of innocence and, you know, renewal.
Well, nothing makes me happier than that, because, like, I'm a real, like, stickler. I've so love the double entendre in the nicest way. Not obviously, I don't mind, you know, a sexy double entendre either, but I mean, more like if something has more than one meaning to it, that just really makes me happy. I can't tell you the joy I get from that. You know, I don't often seek it out, but if I catch a whiff, I definitely will you know, reel that in. I love that. I think, once again, that just goes back to when you were young and you listened to something and you didn't know what it was about, and then you get the other meaning of it. And you're
get
like,
your
oh,
meaning, yeah. You
wow,
kind of superimpose
two things.
You know, it's you know? Funny because I've considered this about songwriters more recently, but I used to think about this back in high school. You'd be going in an English class, you're reading Dickens, right? Mm-hmm. And the teacher's like, "What do you think he meant by that?" I'm like, "Well, I don't know. I mean, he kind of said what he meant, right?" And then it's like, "No, did he?" And you realize, like, this maniacal guy is sitting here going like, "Oh, I'm going to really screw with people and put this in." You know?
No, the subtext is real.
Yeah.
The subtext is real, man.
So are you seeking the subtext in this case, or it's just, like you said, it's nice when it happens naturally?
Usually I don't know if it's, I'm not sure. Like, you'd have to be
a real sick bastard,
certain kind of guy to be able to seek it out. But usually something presents itself, and I definitely have an eye out for it, you know? And so that, you know, that's a really fun thing. I mean, that, you know, that I have a personal fetish with. I love a double meaning.
Well, I think you really want to, as a writer and a performer, to invite people in to attach their own meaning.
Absolutely.
To, you know, so there's an art to teasing that out.
Yeah.
So,
I normally wouldn't explain things, but, like, for example, Lost Soul, usually when I explain it to people, they're sort of like, "Oh, that's actually sort of interesting, you know. I thought it was about a homeless guy." Like, it could totally be about a homeless guy. Yeah. You know, walking the streets, he's, you know, seeing the cars go by and the dog in the road, and kind of a lost soul. You know, it works on both levels, and that just makes me super happy.
And since it's a Kirk Adams song, I hope you take this as a compliment. I picture it as a nighttime scene.
Oh, thanks.
Because a lot of your stuff, just, it's like denizens of the night, you know. I may have even read that phrase on your website. Sounds like a cliche.
Yeah.
But a lot of your stuff, I don't know if it's because you're kind of a nighttime guy.
Nighttime troubadour?
Yeah.
I mean, but I agree. There is a spooky is not the right word, but almost like a
noir.
Noir.
I take spooky in a pinch.
Yeah, no, but well, it's funny that Ed's saying that because I totally feel the same thing listening to a lot of your stuff. You know, Lost Soul just played, and what's the other one? My Eyes Are Getting Used to the Dark, which is one hopefully you'll do for us here in a second. But that's one that it's almost got this. Sorry, HBO, but True Blood feel to it.
That's fine.
You know, this very like. Not swampy, but there's just a lot of soul in it. But it's dark, but at the same time, not melancholic. Like, it's a nighttime scene, it's dark, but there's almost this, like, I don't know if optimism is the right word, but, like, you're enjoying what you're giving commentary on. And it's not negative, it's not...
It's accurate.
You know what I mean?
It's
like,
accurate, yeah.
Almost like a Vincent Price, not, you know, not his aunt, but that's sort of where he's, like, he's commentating on what's happening. And it's spooky and it's noiric, but at the same time, he seems to be really enjoying himself, you know, and the audience is connecting.
Yeah, the character, quote unquote, in that song is definitely just embracing, you know, the nightlife and the darker aspects of that, you know, whatever you make of that what you will. But it's kind of funny because I started writing that song with I'm tired of thinking about the Halcyon days, which led me to think about I do this all the time. What does Halcyon mean exactly? Like, I was thinking maybe it was like some sort of a Greek god or something, seemed, you know, like a good choice. But I ended up looking it up, and it turns out that it's more of like a phoenix bird sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so then that led me to the next line, you know, that pretty bird has gone and left the nest. You
right.
know, and I love, you know, that can be a fun way when you're working with songs. As you're learning, you kind of, you know, it informs your lyrics as you get a little bit more information about, you know, just the thing that pop into your head.
It's funny, that lyric sticks with me in that song. I remember the first time hearing you play that live, and like I noted it, but I didn't come back to like what does that mean? But I think it speaks to, and this definitely happens to me, where I'll hear a songwriter say something, and I'm like, I don't know if that's a real word, but I trust this person's lyrics, and I trust them as a songwriter, so like, cool, yeah, that's legit, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, once again,
it's funny to hear you say, you're like, I didn't even really know what that meant. It came out, you know.
Yeah, well, being like well, I knew the term of like Halcyon days, you know, the good old days and everything.
Sure.
So yeah, I knew kind of what I was getting at, but I had to know a little bit deeper. I mean, that's one of the greatest things about the internet. Everybody can pick on all they want, but to have that infinite source of information is just the greatest thing to me. I love it. But and so then just, you know, writing through that song, I was just sort of, I had the title for a long time, and I'm like, this is a good title. I don't want to screw this up with some crappy lyrics and stuff, you know. And there probably were a few attempts at writing something else, and then as I was formulating this idea, I'm like, oh yeah, I got that. This is going to go together. You know,
the concept led you back to, this is that title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which doesn't happen all the time, but that's why it's nice to hang on to some good titles.
That's,
you know,
that leads to our next question,
okay.
Which we always ask, early episodes, we just asked, are you music first or lyric first?
Right.
But we started asking now, are you music first, lyric first, or title first? Because so many people do start with a title.
We got tired of being corrected.
A lot of people start with titles.
Yeah, yeah. Which kind of surprised us.
It's a latter day development for me too, I think.
Okay.
Because it used to be, I would like the song Jane, you know, it was just a matter of sitting with a guitar, just everything kind of happened all at once, you
right.
know, with an idea. But I find that, for me, historically speaking, lyrics were always the struggle. And so these days, I would go so far as to say that even though I do write from titles sometimes, as I've just proven, but I often write from lyrics these days. I start with like a feeling and an idea of where I'm at, and I start writing. And then usually a title will present itself. In this particular case, I had a title sitting around. Mm-hmm. But I didn't actually write it to that title either, to be fair, you know.
Do you keep a list of titles?
Like, sure.
You think, that would make a good title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, like, people make that joke about you're out in a bar talking and you laugh about something. I'll make a great song title. It's like, I'll put that away. You know?
You're not above stealing that if you're having a conversation with somebody in a bar.
Like, yeah.
You're like, that's terrible. See,
their eyes bright up, you know?
Like that.
Yeah. But, like, you know, that's just an example. But, I mean, the same thing can happen just driving down the street and you see a guy walking under a bridge and you're hit by, like, something. You know what I mean? That can hit you as a title, and you put that stuff away. I mean, that's just the craft of songwriting, which is, you know, everybody approaches a different way. Stan Ridgway, is that his name?
Mm-hmm. From
Wall of Voodoo.
Wall of Voodoo, yeah.
I think he said in an interview that he's one of the guys, I can't remember what the art is, but he would take just words he liked and put them in a
mm-hmm.
Crown Royal bag.
Cut them up.
Yeah, and just draw them out and, yeah. You know, oh, look, Mexican radio. I've got a song, you know?
Yeah, I think that's from the Surrealist movement.
Yeah,
so one of those guys, André Breton or somebody, yeah. Like, would do that. Automatic writing, they would call
nice
it.
Nice to have a smart guy around.
It is. That's why he's here. Yeah. Yep. I needed to bring the IQ up over double digits.
Well, that's what I was getting at, though, is that there's a lot of ways to – the craft of writing songs and the way you get to it. I mean, there's so many ways to do it. Stevie Nicks writes from dreams, you know, right. Literally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I dreamed this song, or she says it.
Anyway, pretty on the nose, yeah.
I would believe her.
Well, it's, you know, Amanda Shires – not to go back to Jason Isbell, but I heard an interview with her, Chris Shiflett's podcast, Walking the Floor, and she talked about writing her most recent record, and literally, she would cut the lyrics up and tape them around the house, and then she like said she even moved into their closet for a while just to like isolate herself while she was writing. So it was like, oh my gosh, that's nuts.
That's fantastic. That,
you know? But super, yeah. Super unique, and people write so differently.
Yeah.
I'm curious, too, about when you're pairing your music to these lyrics. Are you somebody that's writing music to the feel of the song, or are you somebody that can have like noiric lyrics but it's a really upbeat tune?
Well, I mean, that can always happen, but I think it has to do with just where your feeling is. There's a handful of times where I may have like tried different chord progressions for a set of lyrics, but you know, usually it kind of comes along afterwards, because I can't help but, and you guys are both songwriters, so I know you already think the same thing, but it's pretty hard to be sitting and writing lyrics and not some sort of melody, yeah, or something going through your head. There's usually little something.
Right. It's like somebody writing a script and not, yeah, already having an actor in mind. You know? Yeah. I hear you on that for sure.
Yeah. And I compare it to going into the underworld and pulling out the, you know, it's like just a little ghosty, mm-hmm, of an idea, you know, and then you have to go down and make it solid and find the little bits and pieces. And the craft is not a lot of fun for people. And I've let a lot of the craft go to some degree. Like I said earlier, like if I feel a song is done,
mm-hmm,
then I don't really see any reason to. If I'm making the point and the atmosphere is there and it's not a minute and a half long, then, you know, you feel like there's enough of a song here. I don't really need to belabor the point. I've said what I have to say.
Right, because too often you, yeah, overdo something as an artist, yeah, because you're so self-critical and, you know, it was good as was, right?
I think so, and I think, yeah, that sometimes it takes away from it. I think it does even in like successful artists, you know. Can I pick on successful artists? I mean, I hate,
sure,
you,
absolutely.
But like, name names.
Look, you're smiling. You're like, wow, this is great.
It's one of Ed's favorite pastimes.
Well, it's not a popular thing, but if, you know, but I'm like, for example, you talk about, you guys have your Jason Isbell, you know, things. I'm like, just not, I've never really
been.
You
had to go there. I didn't want you to go there.
Oh, like, of course.
But we've gone.
I'm not a big Billy Joel fan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, huh. And I know the Billy Joel. I know when I hear the songs, that is a good song. Everything about it's good. You know, it goes to all the right places. It's got a full set of lyrics, maybe six verses. You know,
mm-hmm,
but to me, like it's like you you did it all the first half of this song. It doesn't need to be, you know, you don't need to do another verse where you're saying the same thing just in a slightly different way,
mm-hmm,
than you already did halfway through the song. Just as an example, I hate to pick on Billy Joel, but he doesn't give two craps what I think. So I guess I can do that.
Billy, okay, if you're listening.
But I think he's a good example to me of like somebody who, I think, they overwork it. And you're like, you know, you didn't need to do all that, you know?
Yeah, I don't know about Billy Joel specifically for me, but I can think of songwriters certainly where, yeah, I've thought that too.
Yeah.
And then I've thought of other ones where I'm like, you missed a verse.
Yeah,
you know,
sure,
the opposite's true. Yeah. Like, how'd the story end? I don't understand.
Well, there's
why
no
is
doubt
this significant?
Yeah, there's no doubt that's the case. And I'm not going to pat myself on the back and say that I ended every song where it needed to be ended. But I just think it's something that I try to pay attention to as far as, you know. So I like to kind of make my point and get in and get out as best I can.
Well, before we get too far away from it, let's do My Eyes Are Getting Used to the Dark, because it's what's one I really dig.
I'd like to point out one other word to watch for in this song.
Please.
In the third verse. Snickleway.
Snickleway.
Yeah.
That's an invented word, right?
No.
No?
No. Okay. It's a snickleway is a little narrow alleyway, specifically in Yorkshire, England. They call them snickleways.
Awesome.
Interesting.
And so, you know, when I was writing this story and I was thinking about the the alleyways and stuff, I was like, oh, that's Snickleway. Let's stick that in there. And
so how did you stumble across that word?
Oh, well, like I'd been to York.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I've been you went with Gail, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Gail and, okay. and how you ended up in England and Scotland. And
okay. Yeah. Well, you know, a few years back, we decided to move over to Scotland for a little while. Gail's Scottish, and mm-hmm. We were over there for about 6 months. And got to play all over town, met a lot of really cool people, played in Edinburgh and St. Andrews, and we did a little Highland tour and went back and forth for a while to Scotland. You know, we got some roots there of sorts.
Should we say, we should introduce who Gail is.
Yeah, Gail Tripsmith, right?
Yeah.
She's a talented musician.
Yeah, she's a great songwriter and
maybe you guys
a lovely lass. Yeah, I'll put again a good word for you guys.
We'd appreciate that.
So Snickleway just kind of found its way into your consciousness while you were over there.
Yeah, because you run across a word like that, you know. Once again, it's like a song title or some other. You run across a word like that, you're like, oh yeah, you know, a great word.
Might not literally go into the notebook, yeah. But it's
which is a great word. You like to know nice words, you know.
If you hadn't already used it, I would totally write a song just around that word.
Snickleway.
If I'd heard it out of context, and someone's like, Snickleway, I'd be like, what? And then someone said, oh, it's British. And I'd say, I'd assume it was some type of profanity.
Of course it is.
it's some type of profanity. Like
some sort of profanity.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
Derogatory.
I don't know if I was as sharp as I might be making myself sound, but I can see that having it in that particular line with the other definitions of an alleyway and a mm-hmm. you know back street, Snickleway, a person would be able to mm-hmm. ascertain, if you will.
That's exactly what it painted that picture for me.
Mm-hmm,
let's hear that one.
I'm done thinking about the halcyon days. That pretty bird has gone and left the nest. I'm leaving town with the upside downer. I'll build a hideout in the black earth's breast. And my eyes are getting used to the dark. My eyes are getting used to the dark. I'll drain my cup until the sun comes up. My eyes are getting used to the dark. I'm not sitting down with the front row sinners. I've lost faith in foolish sunbeaming. I call a spade whenever it hits me. Shovel the dirt in my face as I lay dreaming. My eyes are getting used to the dark. My eyes are getting used to the dark. I'll drain my cup until the sun comes up. My eyes are getting used to the dark. Stumble down the Snickleways, streets and back alleys, playing possum with a banjo on my knee. Don't try to drown me in a daytime drama. Don't send your dagger dogs digging after me. My eyes are getting used to the dark. My eyes are getting used to the dark. I'll drain my cup until the sun comes up. My eyes are getting used to the dark. My eyes are getting used to the dark. My eyes are getting used to the dark. I'll drain my cup until the sun comes up. My eyes are getting used to the dark.
And now, a quick interlude about one of the companies supporting this podcast. Ed, I think we can both agree that the best tasting songs are those that happen naturally.
That's true. Wait, you can't really taste a song, though. That part's not.
That's also true of the food we choose to consume, which is why our favorite new artist on the healthy protein charts is ButcherBox.
100% grass-fed beef delivered on dry ice to your door anywhere in the lower 48.
So, does that make Alaska like the upper...
Ed, just open the box. If you're into more genres than just beef, ButcherBox has you covered. They also deliver Alaskan wild sockeye salmon, free-range organic chicken...
Wow, there's gotta be like 11 pounds of meat in here.
Heritage breed pork and special bacon.
Special bacon?
Special, because it's free. Use code SONGDIVERS at checkout to get $20 off and free bacon in your first ButcherBox. And shipping's free too.
Special bacon and special shipping. That's special.
Now, can you grill as well as you can play guitar? Visit ButcherBox.com to order.
Yeah, that definitely has that True Blood feel like I was saying before.
I think it's a great compliment. I love that song, so, you know. What are the true? I guess what the True Blood theme.
Well, I get I don't know. Chris Isaac almost.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know if you would cite him as an influence or not, but I get a Tom Waits vibe from a lot of your songs that are like that. That kind
I appreciate
dark underbelly. Like,
yeah, I'm a huge fan of his, but I think like a lot of artists, I kind of came to him sideways via other artists. You know, like I think
like the Eagles.
I think
Elton John.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Elvis Costello borrowed a little bit for a period of time there. I think, you know, prior to...
That was the other thing I was going to mention, that Blood and Chocolate era. Like, it felt like...
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
I hear Costello, too. I certainly hear that. There's a little bit of a Warren Zevon feel to some of your stuff to me, also.
Making me a happy man.
Oh, he's incredible. Was incredible, is incredible. But just, he had such a unique way of perceiving and relaying things, I think, lyrically, that were very matter of fact, but also very descriptive and a lot of imagery too, but just like really thought provoking, you know. And I hear a lot of that.
Well, I like Warren Zevon a lot, and I think that a thing that I would bring up about songwriting again in relation to maybe the song I just played, and Warren Zevon and Elvis Costello and Tom Waits, is their use of specifics in their songs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not like there are specific images. There's like hard objects or names or things that make them like it makes it a very real experience to listen to, as opposed to maybe what you typically find in popular music these days, where it's more of like just a general diary reading of, you know, something that happened to somebody, you know.
Sure.
Having those specifics, I think, just make things fantastic. I love actually, once again, I think Warren Zevon, I came to even past those other guys, you know, like all that's connected. They're all connected in a way.
Right.
But I remember the first time I heard Tom Waits. It's a fun story for me. I was working in Orlando and had a 2-hour drive back to Ocala with my brother Doug. We were playing in a band together, and he turned me on to Frank's Wild Years in the car. It was raining terrible. It was a 2-hour ride, and I think we must have listened to it twice with just our jaws open, you know, like in the ride, you know. And we get to the house, and I'm like, that's just the craziest thing I'd ever heard up to that point.
Yeah.
And though I recognized then where other people were maybe getting some of their sounds and some of the things they were doing. I'm like, okay, this is making sense. I'm connecting the dots. But nonetheless, on a visceral level, I was pretty moved and like, I'm doing everything wrong, you know? And then I get out of the car and he drives off and I don't have my keys. And it's raining, pouring rain. And all I'm hearing is...
It's the Tom Waits curse.
It's in my head, you know?
In a Tom Waits song.
Yeah, I just became in a Tom Waits song. But that night always stuck with me because, of course, obviously, I really love that record. That one has sort of a loose theme of a guy going to New York City, kind of a loner, loser sort of guy. I'm going straight to the top.
Yeah.
And but it's just a great such a song. And one of the other things I would like to mention about all those artists, and that I would say I would like to think that I bring on, and I think also goes back to your point about True Blood, is what it's really important to me about songwriting and recording, especially too, in production, is just an atmosphere.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, songs got to have ghosts in it somewhere.
Yes.
You know, and so I definitely do strive and to you know, to make sure that, you know, I do what I can to lure them in, you know, to the magic circle.
There's a couple interesting things that you just talked about, and one of them has to do with lyrical content, and then the other one is the atmosphere. But to go back to the lyrical content, when I'm hearing you talk about concrete you know, examples in the writing. It makes me think of what when people describe a literate songwriter.
Uh-huh.
You know, you have to paint a scene. Are you a big reader? Like, do you do any other kinds of writing, or like?
I do a little bit. I would never, you know, give myself credit for being any kind of an actual writer, but I've written some, you know, some prose and.
But did you like to do a lot of reading? Like, I hear science fiction like references in your writing all the time too. Like, it's
And I'm curious if you're not a big reader. To Ed's point, where's your tool belt coming from? Is it from other songwriters? Like, what are you listening to now?
Well, I'm not a small reader. I used to read a lot more, you know, back in the day. So I probably did a lot of my forming my vocabulary at that time.
A lot of dictionary and encyclopedia reading.
Well, just in reading the dictionary. But like conversations with intelligent human beings can never be underappreciated. I mean, that's a great thing.
Well, let us apologize. In
but advance. I will say that I've learned a lot of things about the world from music. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of a sideways conversation, but I mean, like, when I was over in Britain, like, I knew so many terms and so many things from just listening to, you know, Squeeze albums, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. all these little turns of phrases, because they're not shy in using, you know, their local slang and their local things. And once again, mm-hmm. that makes it just so much more interesting and important and good than if it's just a big generic, you know, bunch of words that, you know, are probably a love song. You know?
Right. And that's so interesting about music too, for what you're saying about atmosphere. There's the lyrics. And there's the atmosphere, so let's just call it music for the, you know, the sake of this. But you have the musically interesting stuff, you know. And if you're a even remotely educated listener, you're a musician, you're around music, you dive in, you play. Like, there's you look forward to albums that like surprise you musically, you know?
Absolutely.
And then there's the lyrics. It could be a super simple song, and then somebody says something, and you're just like you're almost like, wow, that was cool, you know, and it just catches you. And it's so interesting to hear you talk about how, like, sometimes that's just because it's a dialect or it's the way of speaking that you're just not used to hearing.
Right. Well, you know, I went through a period of reading a lot of poetry and things, and there were people that I liked, you know, that I definitely felt mm-hmm. were helped to inform writing. I think that, you know, if you look at, like, Poe and H.P. Lovecraft, like, their use of words were very specific to create an atmosphere and create a mood, you know. And you could start seeing that in stuff that wasn't quite so cartoonish as maybe, you know, a horror, you know. But you could see that in other writing and in other ways. And even just gentle implications of your coffee getting cold on a table, you mm-hmm. know, gives you puts you in a position and you understand what's going on mm-hmm. somehow, even though that's just a little, you know, thing that's mm-hmm. happening.
Right.
So I think that's very important if you want to make something atmospheric and make people be drawn into it, like a story. Even if it's not a story, I don't really consider myself a story songwriter because I find that's a little too, here's how the story goes. And then you're like, well, I can't read into it as much as I'd like to. I'd mm-hmm. like to just for there to be enough pictures, enough shadows on the wall for you to be able to go, I think I know what this means. At least I think I know what it means to me.
That's you
know?
Very lyrical in itself. I like that, shadows on the wall. I think it's important talking about atmosphere too to let people know if they aren't familiar with your stuff, and I hope that they will go become familiar with your stuff. If they go see you, what you're doing here, which is very Tom Waits, as we just talked about, but your live show is all over the board in terms of things that I'm getting. Like, I mean, there's a song that'll be almost Hear the Police. There's a very, you're a really tasty player. You play a Strat, you favor a Strat on stage, which sounds really good. You've got it super dialed in, and you're one of those players that, like, it just looks like you're just barely touching the strings while you're playing. You're not jamming it, and it's just, there's a comfort. In a very smooth nature of the way you play. It's almost Knopfler-esque, very Mark Knopfler-esque.
Lovely.
And
thanks.
I hear a lot of that through a lot of the stuff. But I think it's important for people to know that the atmosphere you're hearing here, which is great, is very different in your live setting. Like, a lot of the stuff still permeates. You know, there is still that spooky nature, some Poean feelings in some of the stuff that is meant to be. But the atmosphere created in a live show, there's a lot more going on. And the dynamics and the types of musical influences are there's a lot more going on. So I think if you get a chance to come see Kirk, definitely go do that. And you're a resident at the Hideaway too,
yep.
which I think is really important to definitely note. If you're coming through St. Pete, Tampa area and you get a chance to get to the Hideaway, try and do it on a night that Kirk's playing. You will not regret that.
I kind of want to take that a little further too, because your live show is fun. You know, even with the subject matter of a lot of your songs being sort of dark, I think it's interesting to note that your latest is Night Owls. Is that your latest release?
It is, yeah.
And so a lot of those songs, I think they just grew out of your live performance, right? As opposed to sitting down and what people think of as a songwriter sitting alone with a guitar kind of crafting songs. Didn't Correct. A lot of that album kind of, the genesis of that album was on stage with your guys.
That is like, accurate. Yeah. Every song on there, with the exception of one, was totally, just pretty much ad-libbed initially on stage. And then, I kind of touched some things up, down the road.
Right.
But
it was just out of the spontaneity of being on stage with some of your favorite players that you're,
Yeah. Well, with good players that could follow whatever I wanted to do, mm-hmm. which makes a big difference. And also, it was just fun. And then I just didn't really expect necessarily to ever do the songs or for anybody to even like them or care about them. I was just having a good old time.
Right.
And then you start getting requests for it. And you're like, oh, well, I guess I better tighten this up, a little bit,
Yeah. Like, I can totally hear Mexican Wrestler just being a total joke, but then people were like, yeah,
that's
play that
exactly
one.
What happened.
That's a great tune.
There's one of the songs on there that I find to be interesting. Once again, a lot of times I find these things to be interesting in retrospect. I guess I'm not that observant of what I'm doing when I'm doing it. But I can play a little bit of it for you.
Yeah,
and I'm going to quiz you. I'm going to quiz you a little bit afterwards.
No, do it, man.
I'm just going to play a version of chorus kind of a thing. And this was pretty much written on stage. You could hurt me and it would be bad. I should run away, but I can't, 'cause I'm drawn to you. It's hard to explain. I don't really want to be, but I'm drawn to you. Yeah, I'm drawn to you. I can't stop thinking. I can't sleep. I'm scared to death that you're gonna change things. 'Cause I'm drawn to you and you're drawn to me. You've got to be strong now, 'cause I'm drawn to you. Yeah, I'm drawn to you.
I'm so glad you went there, because I love that song.
Well, the one of the funny things about that song that I didn't notice until after the fact, did you notice anything strange or not quite usual as far as the song goes?
Yeah, you were not rhyming certain lines.
It doesn't rhyme.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which I just
but
thought was like...
But it did not work.
Yeah.
No,
and I just...
Yeah, it worked.
I remember just like... I didn't really think about it because obviously I was just ad-libbing it on stage at the time. I was just pouring my heart out, And then you're like, you go back home and think, maybe I'll clean it up a little bit, see what I can get. And I'm like, it's all there, It doesn't need to rhyme. But
I wondered if it was intentional because the lyric you're talking about, like, I'm worried that you're going to change things.
Right.
So you change what you're, like, the audience is expecting you to do.
Well, I'm not thinking that far ahead.
I kind of took for granted that was an intentional thing that it's like, I'm going to throw
I'm
you
glad
off.
You caught that, though, because I was just surprised by that myself. And I'm like, that's... I guess when you want to talk about songwriting, because this is, we're talking about songwriting sort of, I think it's just an example, not that it's the greatest song in the world, but it's just
actually,
an example that...
This is a show about tennis.
No,
tennis,
and it is the greatest song in the world. So.
It's just an example that you... Yes. That, once again, you don't have to follow certain, things that people think, like a song should rhyme.
Sure.
By and large, a song should rhyme, but it does. You can see that it doesn't have to, and sometimes it can be maybe more impactful because it doesn't have a sing-songiness to it. And hopefully it may be more penetrating emotionally because it's not like, you don't have to do love and dove and,
right.
Shove the glove.
You don't want to break the illusion.
Yeah.
But enough to shake you from, the lethargy of what the first verse and a half did, right?
Yeah. Well, if you've ever written a love letter to anybody, it better not rhyme. You know what I mean?
That's actually a really interesting point.
Because that's, any lover is going to see through that as a fabrication, as a attempt to, make you feel emotional in a certain way. But if you can be direct with lyrics or with your love letters, you're going to have a better chance of getting your point across, you know, I think.
I want you to... I mean, that's pretty direct.
That's good. Well, hey, if you're Robin Zander, I think everything's going to work out just fine. I think he knows what he's doing.
That's that tune there, too, especially to hear you writing that live. Like, I just hear like a like an addict coming to terms.
Yeah.
But like, you know, with a person.
That's nice. That's not what it's about at all.
No?
No, but that's fine. That's why it's nice to have the double.
But I mean, when I say addict coming to terms, like, not a drug, but a person being a drug for you almost.
Oh, yeah, I get that. It can go in both ways. Once again, I love that. You know, you could interpret it in different ways.
So right wait, there. Wait. That song's not about heroin?
That song's not specifically about heroin. What is it? What is this? It's the 2010s, man. We're talking about Adderall, right? That's what. Who does heroin? I guess they still do, don't they? Oh, well. Them with their heroin addictions.
Those crazy lurking heroin
in the darkness.
The heroines. Yeah. Careful with the heroin business here. Kirk, can you talk a little bit about. And we've talked a little bit in larger scope about. Finding, you know, being a musician to be a viable way to make a living. And how does a guy who's playing a bunch of covers, and you can give as detailed as you want or just kind of give a little bit of the story of, I mentioned you're a resident at the Hideaway, a really well-respected venue here, not in Fort Lauderdale. So you made your way up, you landed in St. Petersburg, Tampa mm-hmm. area. And how do you end up being a guy that's doing all original stuff as a resident performer at a really great venue that's well-respected here?
I mean, I can only speak from, you know, direct experience, so I don't know what's repeatable, but I think that you, when I moved up to town, you know, I got to meet people and sat in and played music with other good artists in town. I was lucky enough to be able to be invited to play with them on a regular basis. You know, you kind of get your name known a little bit, and when you have a cool venue like the Hideaway or a place that does original music, you bring yourself down there and you show them what you got. I know they have an open mic night on Thursdays, I'm pretty sure, you know, so if you're wanting to play original music, you've got to go out and play original music, you know.
So you have the proverbial tap on the shoulder.
Well, and if you, you know, if you have gigs in a regular club somewhere, you know, you just throw in some tunes, you know, or make them up on the stage if you need to. But like, you know, yeah, you know, get your songs out there. Always play your music. If you're a songwriter, just don't not play your music. You know, it's just not right. You know, get out there and play it for people. And let them find what you've got, and maybe they'll be one of your freaks. They'll like what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
And I don't want to prime your answer to this next question, but as you mentioned, supporting local music, how'd you end up here? You were in Fort Lauderdale. That's a bit of a trek away. How'd you pick the St. Pete, Tampa area?
Well, I used to come up and do some gigs when there were breaks in other gigs in South Florida. Kayla and I would come up and play some of the beach bars and places like that. And so when we finally came back from Scotland, Gail didn't want to go back, and so we were like, we didn't want to go back home to Fort Lauderdale, so we decided to move to St. Petersburg. Not that exciting, but that's you know why we ended up here. And
but you stayed because you loved the local music scene.
Well, absolutely, we did stay because there's a lot of good music. It's a great place to live as a musician. There's a lot of work for musicians just on a basic level, with all the hotels and a lot of bars and stuff opening up all the time. And when I first moved to town, there was such a huge pantheon of fantastic musicians, you know, and bands, you know, in the area, with you know, Dennis Wallace and Rob Tyre, who I got to work with, and you know, Barely Pink, and I think even you know when I was here, Dolores Telescope were just on their way out,
mm-hmm.
and Rebecca Pulley. I mean, just a bunch of great people like already here, and you're like, wow, I'm not gonna play my songs around any of these people.
I've gone through that.
That's the first thing that goes through your head, you know.
Yeah, I'll just talk to him instead.
Yeah, and make friends. And that's, you know, it's been great. I mean, everybody, and actually it has been a very welcoming and good community of musicians. I've not run across a single, you know, negative, you know, people. And I know there's like, you know, I have my finger on some of the other people coming up in the area, you know, like now, Dan Field and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, John's great.
Yeah. And, you know, my honey brethren.
Someday Honey.
Someday Honey, yeah.
Oh, Someday Honey's excellent.
I love those guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Kaylee and Matt Walker and Mark Cunningham
Sam.
And Sam Farmer. Mm-hmm. So I got them all in. I know you guys.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of great music, you know, still happening in the area and a lot of good stuff. It's a really great place to be if you're a musician, I think. And I think it's a really good opportunity. I think that it won't be me, but I think that in the not too distant future, this could really be a good happening and jumping musical spot in a scene, you know. I think it could happen.
Well, and I think too, it's important to note as part of this, the point of this podcast is talking about the songwriter who is trying to get out there and make it, and whatever that means for them, right? And for some people, you know, measuring success, being able to just play music for a living, like, that is success for some people. And Skylar, who is our, one of our photographers here right now, her and I were talking earlier, and she's talking about, like, shooting something maybe you wouldn't otherwise shoot because it just keeps you sharp. You're practicing your craft.
Well, sure.
And cover gigs, although they can be brutal if you're throwing your stuff in once in a while and people aren't paying attention, they are still a great way to hone your craft. You're being, you know, you're on stage, you're getting paid to do it, you get the craft.
Well, you
down.
Learn a lot.
You learn a lot.
You know.
And to be able to do that and support yourself with music while you're trying to make it with your original music, that's important to know about a scene if you're thinking about breaking into one or picking up.
I think especially like if you're a younger person or whatever who's you know, trying to learn more about music and trying to be a good songwriter, there's nothing better than you can do than learn to play other great songs. You know, you learn so much and really listen to your audience. You know, I learned so much as a entertainer from people going like, hey, can you do this song by Neil Young? And I'm like, well, I've never heard that song, but I'll give it a listen. And then you're like, holy crap, this is a fantastic song. You know, you can learn so much from listening to people, you know.
You can. And I think, too, you know, there's a – you talked about the open mic nights at the Hideaway. I remember the first time I went there, and it was intimidating. There was a very high caliber of musicianship, you know, I'd say per capita, that's playing there. But this area, especially now, there's – all formats of getting involved with songwriting, whether it's an open mic night and that be your opportunity, or there's a lot of songwriting groups too, which I think is really cool because you mentioned if you're a young songwriter, and I think that there's a forgiving nature to somebody. It's like, ah, they're new to this, you know? But if you're more advanced in your years and it's harder to learn things, language, instruments, whatever else, and you show up and you want to start doing it, like, that can be intimidating probably. And I think maybe you're still, you've got a unique way of seeing the world and you have a talent for lyrical execution and songwriting at that degree, but maybe not the music, maybe not a great guitar player. There's still an avenue for you to showcase that and people appreciate it. And I think there's a lot of communities where that's emerging more, and we definitely are starting to get that here.
That is a great thing. And that is, you can't stress enough that it's important to get out there and play music with other people. And like you say, I mean, and the, you know, you never know what you have to bring to the table till you start, you know, bellying up and pouring it out there. So, and everybody's got something. I've done, you know, open mic things through my life, and I've been involved in a couple of little scenes like that. And there's always different levels of skill, guitar playing or lyric writing or physically singing or just songwriting ability that all comes together to make an interesting time. You might have a dude who's got a great smooth voice, you know, but he writes kind of simple, not so good songs, but you love hearing him. You know what I mean? And that's a very important aspect of being an entertainer and making music. And then you have, you know, the shy chick with the fantastic lyrics who barely sings in the microphone or whatever. I mean, these are all characters. They're almost archetypes to some degree, you just got to throw yourself in with these people and you're going to learn from them and they're going to learn from you. It's super important. I couldn't agree with you more.
And I think the open-mindedness is such an important thing too.
It should be.
You know, not having preconceived notions about what you're going to find or even a musician that you find intimidating, you know, how much you can take away from them and actually end up feeling really, really motivated by them too.
Yeah.
Once you're accepted as somebody, everybody started somewhere.
And you kind of have to just find your, as dumb as it sounds, you sort of have to find yourself. You've got to find your sound. You've got to find out what you are, or you have to have a vision of what you want to be. And you have to, only you're going to do that as you get out and mix it up with people.
Well, what's coming up for you? What do you got going on next? Are you looking to put another record out soon? Or?
Yeah, I've got about three projects I'm trying to finish up as best I can. Three separate album ideas. And I'm breaking ground. I've got some stuff that's been sitting around, sort of homespun numbers, and I'm getting back in the studio soon to do a lot of the songs that we've been doing at the Hideaway over the last couple of years that have kind of, you know, come to life on that stage. And then I got a whole other set of things too that I'm floating around. I'm writing constantly. I love to write, as I've mentioned before a few times. And so there's always songs coming out. I'm really happy with what I'm getting done. The hard part, of course, is finishing them up and getting them recorded, before I retire. And I'll become a painter.
You doing stuff with George Harris still? Or
I did the recording of the Night Owls, Boogaloo, and Bottle Club. I did the basic tracks at George's.
Mm-hmm.
But this next time, besides the stuff I'm doing at home, I'll be doing actually at the Hideaway.
Oh, good.
It seems like
the way
to go. With
John Kelly? Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to that. And then I have, like I said, a whole other bat. Like, you know, my eyes are getting used to the dark. It really sort of belongs to a whole other set of a whole other album, basically, of material. So I'll hopefully get all done. You know, I'm loving playing at the Hideaway, and I'm very happy with what is going on. I'm really happy to be here. This is so much fun.
Thanks for doing it, man.
Yeah, yeah, thanks, Kirk.
We're looking forward to having you back once you get some of those other projects a little closer to the surface.
I appreciate that, and Thanks a bunch.
You want to take us out with another one? How about something from Undertown? We didn't talk about the Undertown album, but I think it's a Kirk-defining moment, that album. You got something from that one you want to...
Yeah, the Undertown was is sort of a loose theme of the sort of underlying things that control us in a strange way. The lies and the perceptions of things, our subconscious ghosts that push us forward and make us do things, sometimes bad things, sometimes good things. Mm-hmm. But the lies we tell to ourselves and the lies we tell to other people and the motivations are all kind of represented in the album a little bit. And this particular song is just sort of looking at the earth from a different perspective, humanity and things that go on here on the planet, and how there seems to be a cyclical or possibly more of a helix drain sort of thing happening with Earth and people. It's tough on planet Earth, and this song is called Business as Usual.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Kirk. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Kirk.
My pleasure.
He's an old lion hunting for one final deer. Gonna cost him his pride, that slender neck and velvet hide. He drains another beer. Streetlights blink on the savannah, a cub cries somewhere alone. The gazelle lies down on the far side of town, and a dream is gone. What does it mean? What is it worth? It's just business as usual on planet Earth. An army of ghosts, creatures of the garbage can. Heed the satellites in the dead of night, more memory than man. Seeking redemption, forgotten in a haunted space. In a poison oasis, a crossroad glows on a figure of eight. What does it mean? What is it worth? It's just business as usual on planet Earth. What does it mean? What is it worth? It's just business as usual. Business as usual on planet Earth.
Listening to Song Divers.
Thank you for supporting us and our sponsors and all the great independent music makers out there trying to make their way in the music business these days. Songs we heard in this episode were Hindenburg, Lost Soul, My Eyes Are Getting Used to the Dark, Jane, Drawn to You, Business as Usual, and Mexican Wrestler. We encourage you to go down the rabbit hole of all things Kirk Adams. That's spelled K-I-R-K-A-D-A-M-S. On Instagram, it's Kirk Adams Songs. His website is kirkadamsmusic.com. You can hear and purchase his four superlative albums on kirkadams.bandcamp.com. If you live in the Tampa Bay area or you're visiting, by all means get out to a Kirk Adams gig. He plays every week, and it's no accident that his band is composed of a revolving cast of some of the Bay's best musicians. And if you want to buy Kirk a glass of his favorite black centipede oil, I'm sure he won't complain. With a flying moon salt and a Frankensteiner, he hit me so hard I woke up in China. My baby left me for a Mexican wrestler.
Well, that sure was fun. Cheers, everybody. Raise up your drink of choice. Black centipede oil, in my case. I just need a little more of this black centipede oil, and I'll be fine.
Hi, I'm Kirk Adams. I love ravens and cats.
Can you have those both at the same time?
Sure you can.
Because cats go after birds, don't they?
Sure. That doesn't mean you can't have them. You can't have them for long.
Right.
Song Divers is a production of Ybor City Records and recorded in the historic Kenwood district of St. Petersburg, Florida.